We are in 1 Samuel chapter 26 tonight, and next week, Lord willing, the last week of the month, we've been doing a pastoral study week, so we'll have our prayer meeting next week. So this is good. This is a good moment for us to pause after chapter 26, and then we'll cover the last section of the book in the month of January. Chapter 26 is the bottom end of this literary sandwich that we've been looking at. Chapters 24, 25, and 26 have in common certain themes. And chapter 24 and chapter 26 have so much in common that liberal and unbelieving scholars often suggest that it is a duplication of the same story. Now, I have to admit that when I think about some of the critical scholarship and the theories about editing in the biblical documents that are proposed in seminaries and universities and have been since the 19th century, I think, you know, whoever that editor might have been, he should have been fired. If he forgot in two chapters that he had just told this story and then got it so wrong that he couldn't even harmonize these two accounts. I mean, what kind of an editor is that, right? The reality is that these two stories are remarkably similar. And yet they are sufficiently different that there shouldn't be any doubt in our minds that they are two different occasions. It should not surprise us that similar events occur in the lives of God's people, especially when we think about the ways in which God is working in these two accounts to communicate certain lessons, not only to Saul, not only to David, but to the people of Israel as well. Repetition is the key to learning, and God impresses some of these lessons upon the nation as well as the major parties involved in these two accounts. Let's read together chapter 26, and then we'll unpack it for a few minutes this evening. Then the Ziphites came to Saul at Gibeah, saying, "Is not David hiding himself on the hill of Hakilah, which is on the east of Jeshimon?" So Saul arose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph with 3,000 chosen men of Israel to seek David in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul encamped on the hill of Hakilah, which is beside the road on the east of Jeshimon. But David remained in the wilderness. When he saw that Saul came after him into the wilderness, David sent out spies and learned that Saul had indeed come. Then David rose and came to the place where Saul had encamped. And David saw the place where Saul lay with Abner, the son of Ner, the commander of his army. Saul was lying within the encampment while the army was encamped around him. Then David said to Ahimelech the Hittite and to Joab's brother Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, "Who will go down with me into the camp to Saul?" And Abishai said, "I will go down with you." So David and Abishai went to the army by night, and there lay Saul sleeping within the encampment with his spear stuck in the ground at his head, and Abner and the army lay around him. Then Abishai said to David, "God has given your enemy into your hand this day. Now please let me pin him to the earth with one stroke of the spear, and I will not strike him twice." But David said to Abishai, "Do not destroy him. For who can put out his hand against Yahweh's anointed and be guiltless?" And David said, "As Yahweh lives, Yahweh will strike him, or his day will come to die, or he will go down into battle and perish. Yahweh forbid that I should put out my hand against Yahweh's anointed. But take now the spear that is at his head and the jar of water and let us go." So David took the spear and the jar of water from Saul's head, and they went away. No man saw it or knew it, nor did any awake, for they were all asleep, because a deep sleep from Yahweh had fallen upon them. Then David went over to the other side and stood far off on the top of the hill with a great space between them. And David called to the army and to Abner, the son of Ner, saying, "Will you not answer, Abner?" And Abner answered, "Who are you who calls to the king?" And David said to Abner, "Are you not a man? Who is like you in Israel? Why then have you not kept watch over your lord the king? For one of the people came in to destroy the king, your lord. This thing that you have done is not good. As Yahweh lives, you deserve to die because you have not kept watch over your lord, the Yahweh's anointed. And now, see where the king's spear is and the jar of water that was at his head. Saul recognized David's voice and said, "Is this your voice, my son David?" And David said, "It is my voice, my lord, O king." And he said, "Why does my lord pursue after his servant? For what have I done? What evil is on my hands? Now therefore, let my lord the king hear the words of his servant. If it is Yahweh who has stirred you up against me, may he accept an offering. But if it is men, may they be cursed before Yahweh. For they have driven me out this day that I should have no share in the heritage of Yahweh, saying, 'Go serve other gods.' Now therefore, let not my blood fall to the earth away from the presence of Yahweh. For the king of Israel has come out to seek a single flea, like one who hunts a partridge in the mountains." Then Saul said, "I have sinned. Return, my son David, for I will no more do you harm, because my life was precious in your eyes this day. Behold, I have acted foolishly and have made a great mistake." And David answered and said, "Here is the spear, O king. Let one of the young men come over and take it. Yahweh rewards every man for his righteousness and his faithfulness. For Yahweh gave you into my hand today, and I would not put out my hand against Yahweh's anointed. Behold, as your life was precious this day in my sight, so may my life be precious in the sight of Yahweh, and may he deliver me out of all tribulation." Then Saul said to David, "Blessed be you, my son David. You will do many things and will succeed in them." So David went his way, and Saul returned to his place. It's an exciting story, right? So the first five verses kind of set the scene. And again, we see the repetition of some of the major characters, even the people that are involved, as in an earlier chapter, the Ziphites, dwelling in this region, inform Saul at Gibeah that David is hiding nearby. They give him the location, and Saul gathers 3,000 chosen men. These would be maybe not special forces soldiers, but these would not be farmers. These would be men of war, men who are competent in battle, men of some valor or experience with their king, and they go out to hunt David in the wilderness, to track him down. David finds out about this and sends spies out to confirm it, and realizes that Saul is camped very close to his own position. Verse 5 says that David could see the place where Saul lay with Abner, the son of Ner, who is the commander of his army, and all of the rest of the soldiers, the 3,000 camp around him. Now, David's mighty men will be a subject for a later class, and I really like teaching on David's mighty men. But when I talk about David's mighty men, one of the things I'm going to tell you is that David was the first of all the mighty men. I mean, the reason that David has mighty men around him is because David himself is a mighty man, right? And David has the audacity to look at this picture and say, "I think I can get down there. I think I can make my way down there." Now, there is no indication that God reveals directly to David what we learn in verse 12, and that is that the Lord has placed a deep sleep on the entire army. Now, it's possible that this is where David's boldness comes from. Maybe God reveals this to him in some way. Maybe the Spirit is stirring upon David's heart to create this kind of boldness. Whatever the point of initiation is, God protects David in this little enterprise. And David goes to two of his men, and Abishai, one of the two, says, "I will go." Abishai is identified as Joab's brother in this story. We're going to have a lot more to say about Joab, Abishai, and Asahel. But what you need to be paying attention to is Joab and Abishai's parent, Zeruiah. That is not a male name. That's a female name. But in order to know the significance of that, you're going to need to read the genealogies. Or wait, and I'll tell you in a number of months. Okay, there is an interesting backstory there. I'm just teasing you. I want you to be curious about that. Maybe look that up. Go home and read some genealogies and see if you can figure it out. Abishai is a very bold character, but he's not just bold. Like his brother Joab, he is bloodthirsty. What characterizes Joab and his two brothers, particularly Abishai, is that they are very effective killing machines, but they are largely without conscience. They're exactly the kind of men who are uber competent for war, but not really equipped for peace. Abishai appears to believe that the purpose of this night raid into the camp, David says, "Who will go down with me to Saul?" He presumably believes this is an assassination attempt. If we can get down, maybe David has had a change of heart. Some weeks or months ago, we had an opportunity in the cave to take Saul out. That opportunity was lost. David did not have the boldness that day to do what needed to be done. Now he's had a change of heart, and now we're finally going to take care of it. If we can kill the king, you cut off the head of the snake, the body dies, right? And David will take the throne. Abishai is all about that. And so verse 7, David and Abishai went to the army by night, and there lay Saul, sleeping within the encampment with his spear stuck in the ground at his head, and Abner and the army lay around him. Now, that spear, how many times has that spear been mentioned since chapter 18? A bunch of times. This is the symbol of Saul's power, the symbol of Saul as king. You've got to remember, Israel is still in their infancy in terms of the monarchy. They don't have a capital, really. They don't have a palace. Saul may not have any kind of a crown, right? Certainly not an elaborate gold one. He doesn't have a scepter. The symbol of Saul's reign through the second half of this book has been that spear, usually because he's throwing it at someone. And his preferred targets have been David and on at least one occasion, Jonathan. Now, think about the irony of this picture. Here is the unrighteous king condemned by the Lord. And standing over him is the righteous king anointed by the Lord. Here between them is the symbol of this king's power and an instrument of death by which Saul has endeavored to slay his rival. And now what is Abishai proposing to use to end Saul's life? Right? Those who live by the sword will die by the sword. Or as David's son Solomon will write in the Proverbs, the wicked will dig a pit for the righteous and fall into it. Right? That's what's happened right here. Do you see the providential irony of this moment? I mean, this is rich. This is fitting. We could say, as violent as it is, this is a beautiful moment in which Saul ought to die, right? And Abishai is just giddy with excitement. Now, until you get to verse 12, you wonder, how are these guys having this conversation without some of the centuries or somebody noticing, right? But the Lord has put them all to sleep, and you can imagine in kind of whispered tones and with a lot of gestures, Abishai says, "Let me kill him. Let me strike him one time with this spear. I will not have to strike him twice. I will pin him to the ground." And David says, "No." And he doesn't just say no. It is a reasoned no. It is a no that is founded upon understanding and conviction. It's not a tentative, "Well, maybe we really shouldn't do that," or a fearful, "I don't know if we can get away with it." No, listen to what David says. He says, "Do not destroy him, for who can put out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless?" It's a rhetorical question. The answer is no one. Every reason that could be given to justify the taking of a human life could be suggested here as a reason for David to allow Abishai to kill Saul. Right? David's the king, after all. Well, okay, technically he's not on the throne yet, but he's been anointed as the king. Saul is under the judgment of God. He has already been rejected by the Lord. This would be an act of judicial punishment by the incoming monarch. Moreover, Saul is David's mortal enemy. This is an act of self-defense. Every possible rationale that you could offer applies in this case, it seems like, and yet David has this clarity. He is God's anointed. You cannot kill him. There's no scenario in which taking Saul's life in this context is lawful. And then listen to what he says in verse 10. As the Lord lives, the Lord will strike him. Or his day will come to die. Or he will go down to battle and perish. Basically, I don't know how it's going to happen. I can imagine a lot of different things. Do you remember what Paul says in Ephesians chapter 3 and verse 20 and 21? Now, he says, to him who is able to do exceedingly, abundantly, beyond all that we ask or think. David says, I don't know how the Lord's going to do it. I can imagine a lot of different ways. But I know this. I am not authorized by God to take Saul's life. God does not need my help. I am not going to save myself with my own hand. Does that sound familiar? We'll come back to that in a second. The Lord forbid that I should put out my hand against the Lord's anointed, but take now the spear that is at his head and the jug of water and let us go. It seems to me this is what David came to do all along. This does not appear to me like an aborted assassination attempt. I don't think David goes all the way down there without a plan. I think if you notice, the spear is mentioned early. And I think that David is going to strike his enemy and not kill him, right? To count coup on him. He's going to touch him and say, tag. I can touch you anytime I want to. I am not a threat to you. Right? To assert that God is protecting him. And indeed he is, as we find out with this deep sleep. David goes over to the other side, on the top of the hill, far away. He can call down into the valley. He can make himself be heard, but they can't get to him quickly. And he begins shouting at the army, calling to the king, finally addresses Abner. You can imagine the people are waking up. They're confused. It's dark. They can't see clearly. Maybe there's a torchlight up there where David is standing, or maybe he's backlit by the moon. They can see someone's up there. They hear this voice shouting. They're not sure if they're surrounded. You can imagine the panic that they feel. And then David begins calling to Abner, and he says, are you not a man? Are you not a man? Who is like you in all of this? In other words, you are a man's man. Abner, I thought you were this tough, valiant warrior. What happened tonight? You're sleeping on the ground next to the king. Who's got the king's weapons? Who's got his little jar of water in case he needs a drink during the night? I came and stood over your master and could have taken his life and yours. Now, what did you do about it? David goes so far as to say this: as the Lord lives, you deserve to die. You deserve to die because you did not protect Yahweh's anointed, your master. Now, what do you think the purpose of this is? I think this is psychological warfare. This is not just David being a braggart, right? This is psychological war. This is David recognizing we are involved, like it or not, in war with Saul. But he's taking the moral high ground. He's saying, I am not going to fight this battle with the weapons of man. This is not a carnal conflict to be won with spear and sword. This is going to be fought by faith. This is going to be won by the power of God. And he is seeking to put the fear of God right now into Saul and to Abner and to that army. You do not want to fight a man who cannot be caught because God is protecting him. You don't want to go out into the wilderness and fight someone like David. He is he is the giant killer. And clearly in this episode, as in the previous episode in chapter 24, David can get to anyone he wants. I think it's psychological warfare. He is trying to get inside their heads. He does not want Saul's men rushing into the wilderness with confidence. He wants them cringing as they follow their king's commands. Saul recognized the voice. Is this your voice, my son David? It is indeed, O king. And why does my Lord pursue his servant? We've heard this before. We've heard these kind of things. But there's a step beyond what he said in chapter 24. Notice verse 19. Now therefore, let my Lord the king hear the words of his servant. If it is Yahweh, the Lord, who has stirred you up against me, may he accept an offering. That's the first possibility. I don't think David believes it's a very likely possibility, but he wants to cover all of his bases and acknowledge, if I've done something wrong, if God is chastening me, if God is disciplining me by sending you out, I want to make that right. I want to be reconciled to God. But if it is men, here's the other possibility. May they be cursed before the Lord. This is humble imprecation. And you see it over and over in the Bible. If you remember earlier in 1 Samuel, you saw it at Samuel's farewell address, right? He gathers the nation of Israel and he says to the leaders of the people, all right, which of you have I deprived of an ox, a donkey? Who have I taken advantage of? Who have I misused in any way? Come, bring the complaint, bring the charges, let's make that right. And they all say, oh, no, you've always been fair, you've always been just, you've been an upright and a faithful man. He says, all right, if that's the case, then I've got a few things to say to you, right? This humble imprecation. David says, there are two possibilities here. Either you're out here chasing me because the Lord has moved you to do so. He's provoked you to it. Or it's from man. It's either from heaven or from men, as Jesus says. Which is it? Now, who has actually moved Saul to be out there? It is Satan. But you know what man is responsible for this? It's the one man that David doesn't mention. It's Saul. Who is the man who is responsible for this campaign? This is important for you to see. The man that is responsible for this campaign is Saul himself. What does David say in this verse? May the man be cursed before the Lord. Proverbs says, a curse without a cause does not alight. So if we have a Wiccan show up outside our building and throw a curse on this church, you know what's going to happen? Nothing. Nothing. Right? If you have angry people come and protest outside our worship assemblies, you know what's going to happen? Nothing. I get on the news or something like that. Nothing. You don't have to fear curses that are spoken without cause. You don't have to worry that imprecatory prayers are magic spells that you can accidentally cast and cause harm. That's not the way this works. If you pray and ask God to judge the wicked, guess who's going to get judged? The wicked. If you pray for God's righteous judgment to fall, guess who it's not going to fall on? The righteous. David is being, I think, tactically brilliant here, right? But I want you to see that there's more than just psychological warfare and strategy. There's a spiritual level to what he's saying here. He's saying, if God is responsible for you hunting me in this way, I want to make it right with him. I will. This is exactly what Paul says. Do you remember when Paul is on trial before the Romans? He says, if I've done anything deserving of death, I do not object to dying. Let's just put that on the table right there. If there is a legitimate charge against me, say it. Bring that charge. I will accept responsibility for my crimes. But the whole point of saying that is to highlight the fact it's not God who brought you out here. This is not justified. If God has sent you out here, I will seek to atone for my error through sacrifice. But if it is from man, then may God's curse fall upon him. There's only one man in that group that is responsible for that army being there that night. And that's Saul. And that means that's a curse against Saul. But he has the respect not to say, may God curse you, Saul. Right? There's wisdom in the way that he's saying this. Now, I want you to notice what is so terrible about David's fugitive period. That this is something that is clarified here in chapter 26 that I think is significant. What is so awful about being a fugitive in the wilderness? You say, well, I mean, you're living in the wilderness. You're away from your family. You can't be with your loved ones. You can't live in a city. You're constantly in, your life is in danger. You're looking over your shoulder. You can't stay in one place more than a few nights. This is horrible. This is terrible. That's not what David says. He says, they have driven me out this day that I should have no share in the heritage of the Lord. In effect, whoever is responsible for provoking Saul to hunt David, and it's Saul, as we've said, whoever's responsible for that, what they have done in effect is said, David, you cannot have any part in the inheritance of God's people. You cannot share in the blessings, in the heritage of Yahweh. Now, what does that mean? But look at the last clause. Saying, go serve other gods. Now, is anybody actually literally saying those words to David? No. Is Saul saying, David, we don't want you here. We want you to go worship with the Philistines, with the Moabites, with the Ammonites, with somebody else. Go worship some other god. No, that's not it. Understand what David is saying here. What David is saying is that man who has prompted you to hunt me like a dog in the mountains, that man is cursed by the Lord because he has driven me away from the worship of Yahweh among his people. That's the heritage that he's talking about. Do you see that? What David prizes that he cannot participate in the wilderness is the corporate worship of the saints. That's what he is missing. That is the heritage of God's people. That is his gift to them, is to be able to come to the altar, is to be able to come and bring sacrifice and bring prayers and to participate in the law and sharing in the worship of God's people. Now, all of us as good Protestant Christians, we're saying, well, David just needs to realize that what he needs is a daily quiet time. He needs a Bible reading program. And he needs to learn how to have a personal prayer life. And then he needs to get an app on his phone and listen to sermon audio or whatever like that is. No, that is no substitute. Those are wonderful things. Those are blessings in our lives that we should avail ourselves of. Those are no substitute for the gathering of God's people, for the gathering of the saints. For David, remember, David's the psalmist who writes all of those psalms about personal relationship with the Lord. I kind of think David knows something about that. Maybe he might even know more about that than we do, right? My soul thirsts for you. My flesh longs for you. in a dry and weary land where there is no water. So I have looked for you in the sanctuary. Psalm 63. What satisfies David? Where does he go to find God? It's not just his prayer closet. It's to the people of God. It's to the saints, to the gathering of the saints, where God is pleased to dwell. Right? That corporate worship's important. And David says, listen carefully to what I'm saying. He's saying, may God damn the man who has taken that from me. That's what he's saying. Right? This is the psalmist who writes, I would rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than to dwell in the tents of the wicked. I was glad when they said unto me, let us go up to the house of the Lord. You know what David is missing? He is missing the heritage that God gives to his people. Saul says, I have sinned. Return, my son David, for I will no more do you harm. Yeah, right. Because my life was precious in your eyes this day. Behold, I have acted foolishly and made a great mistake. David, as we saw in chapter 24, he does not trust Saul. He goes his way. He goes back to the stronghold. Here he says, here's your spear. I don't want it. This is significant, by the way. Remember, we said that chapter 24 was very... there was a lot of significance in cutting the corner of the robe, right? The tearing of the robe. God has torn the kingdom away from you, right? There may even be some ancient Near Eastern cultural symbolism there that's beyond what we can be absolutely certain of. Similarly, taking the spear, it's a sign of office. It's a sign of his power. Look, I've got the king's weapon, right? I've got his primary stick, right? This is as good as a scepter. David says, I don't want that. I'm not going to take your office from you. I am not going to take your throne out from under you. I'm not going to steal the crown off your head. I'm not going to keep the spear. I want you to understand, I had it. And by God's grace, I can have it whenever God wants to give it to me. That's what he's saying. But he says, you can have it back. Send one of your young men. The Lord rewards every man for his righteousness and his faithfulness. Now, full stop. Don't think that being a Protestant means denying that statement. That statement in context is not suggesting that David is righteous before God on the basis of his own obedience or the merits of his own work. But understanding the gospel of grace does not mean that you have to deny that God will bless and reward those who are obedient to him, those who are faithful to him. There is a reward for doing good. There is a reward, there is a blessing for the practice of righteousness. And he says, the Lord gave you into my hand this day, and I would not put my hand out against the Lord's anointed. Do you suppose that God was testing David? Behold, as your life was precious this day in my sight, so may my life be precious in the sight of the Lord. And may he deliver me out of all tribulation. David doesn't say, I hope that since your life was precious in my sight, now my life will be precious in your sight. Can we agree on that? David says, no. I mean, we're way past that. There is never going to be trust between Saul and David again, right? But he says, I pray that as I have protected you, God will protect me. And Saul speaks truth. Blessed be you, my son David. You will do many things and will succeed in them. Yes, indeed he will. Okay. Now, that's the main point. Okay, yes. But I've got the main application still to get to. All right, all right.
Oh, I just had a question.
Sure.
How many years was David in this situation of running?
Yeah. Probably around 10.
10 years.
Yeah, maybe so. So it's hard to know exactly because we don't know exactly how old he is. In the Goliath episode, we know that he comes into the kingdom at 30. So roughly a decade.
So quite some time.
It could be quite some time. Yeah. And again, there may have been more years on the front end of that while he's serving as Saul and while that jealousy's building. We're assuming a few years there. It could have been longer there, but it's a while. It's not just a few months. Yeah. Other questions there or thoughts? Okay. All right, so let me go back then and unpack what I think is the main point that we need to take away. Let's go back to this moment where David and Abishai are standing over Saul. And we've talked in these three chapters about the danger of trying to read the tea leaves of providence, about the confidence that Saul's men have in chapter 23, that David's men have in chapter 24, that Abishai has here in chapter 26. God has given your enemy into your hand. Well, in one sense, of course, that's true. Because Saul would not be lying unconscious in front of David with a weapon stuck in the ground next to his head unless God had ordained that that would be, right? So the fact that Saul is in David's hand right now means God put him there. The question is, what are you supposed to do with him, right? God has handed Saul to you. What are you supposed to do with him? And I asked the question just a minute ago. Do you suppose that the Lord is testing David? I mean, I think God is sanctifying us in every circumstance of our lives, good and bad, right? When we perform well, as David did here, and when we perform poorly, as David did in the last chapter. I also suggested that this is not a coincidence that David goes down into the camp, stands over Saul, takes the spear, takes the jug, and has reasoned conviction for telling Abishai not to kill Saul. You can argue that in chapter 24, it is a coincidence of moment, right? Not a coincidence from God's standpoint, obviously. But David's not hiding in the cave waiting for Saul. He's hiding in the cave waiting for Saul to leave, and then Saul walks into the cave. He's, oh, here he is. The point is, Saul overtakes David in the cave. David goes down to Saul here. Do you see the difference? David seeks out this opportunity. And then listen again to what he says. Do not destroy him, for who can put out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? As the Lord lives, the Lord will strike him, or his day will come to die, or he will go down into battle and perish. The Lord forbid that I should put out my hand against the Lord's anointed. He's thought about this. He says more here than he does in chapter 24. He has sought out a repetition of opportunity. Abishai presumably believes that it's because he's had a change of heart. We are going to take out Saul. David says, no, we're not going to take him out. What has David learned? And let me ask it this way. What has changed since last time? Well, what's happened since the cave incident? Chapter 25. David and Nabal, right? Nabal, the fool, who insults David grossly. I mean, inexcusably. It's so offensive that God kills Nabal. But all Nabal does is insult David. It's not as though he throws a spear at him to pin him to the wall. It's not as though he goes after his family. It's not as though David has to flee for his life. All he does is insult David. And David is ready not only to kill Nabal, but every man in Nabal's household. He is ready to wipe out that estate. And what does he learn? From the counsel of Abigail, who comes in such an humble, gracious way, he learns, number one, you don't want to sin by shedding blood. It's not always a sin to take a human life, if there is justification for it. But you don't want to sin by taking human life, shedding innocent blood when there is no justification, because then this will be a burden for you. She says, when in time to come, when the Lord elevates you, you will have this blood guilt. And secondly, what did she say? Three times. She says it twice. David says it once in chapter 25. What did they say? That you will not have the regret, having sinned, seeking to save yourself by your own hand. There's the key to this episode in chapter 26. Guy.
So I don't know if this would ring with you, but vengeance is mine, saith the Lord.
Right.
I will repay.
Exactly.
In the first instance, providence gave him an opportunity, and by faith he resisted. Second time, God kept him in his unfaithfulness.
Yes.
Third time, he was faithful and demonstrated his faithfulness. But it's the counterpart of the New Testament is, even though we are faithless, he remains faithful.
Exactly.
He will not deny himself.
Exactly. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And what you're seeing, I think, in these three chapters is God sanctifying David, growing him in just those ways, right? The first time, David doesn't go looking for this. The opportunity comes to him. The second time, it's clear that David doesn't understand. The good decision that he made in chapter 24, he doesn't understand the principle. He doesn't understand the application. He doesn't understand the implications of it. Chapter 25, he learns. Chapter 26, we see he's grown. He says, God's going to take Saul out. How do you know that? He took Nabal out. I didn't have to kill Nabal. I didn't have to defend my name. I didn't have to take vengeance with my own hand. God took care of my enemy there, and he'll take care of this one here. God will strike him down, or he'll die in battle, or his day will come to die in some other way. I don't know how God's going to do it. I just know that he's going to do it. And I can wait. I can be patient, because this is God's doing, not mine. Give place to wrath. Give place for vengeance. We've said before, vengeance is not wrong. Vengeance is God's. You got to know the difference. I've mentioned before this little series of commentaries by Dale Ralph Davis, a PCA pastor and Old Testament scholar, very readable. He had a quote on this section that I thought was terrific. I want to read it to you quickly. He says, quote, God's ways will frequently baffle us, but God's will is sufficiently clear to lead us in the meantime. God's ways may not be clear, but our way is, at least, enough of it to know what obedience requires. We may wait for God's providence, but we already have God's law. And that is all we need for the moment. End quote. That's good. That's really good. I love the distinction that he's making there between God's ways, which are mysterious to us, hidden from us much of the time, and God's will, which is revealed to us, made known to us. What is God doing? No, wrong question. What does God command me to do right now in this situation? That's what I need to know. Well, I don't understand, I don't know why. You don't have to. The secret things belong to the Lord our God. The things revealed belong to us and our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law, Deuteronomy 29:29. He's given us these commandments for our good always, Moses says in Deuteronomy chapter 6. Always. It's always good to do God's will. I don't have to understand. I don't have to know how, when God will resolve certain things. All I have to do is be faithful where I am. And as Brother Davis points out, I may not always understand even all of the things that may be required of me in this moment, but I know enough to know what I ought to do right now. And that's enough. That's enough. This situation is puzzling to us. We say, David's life would have been so much better, so much easier, if he just killed Saul. And it seems right for him to kill Saul. I mean, how could that be wrong? There's so many reasons to do it. And David knows it's not right, if for no other reason than he would be working salvation with his own hand. He would be stepping into God's place. He says, I won't do that. We are not going to do that. What we are going to do is take the spear, take the jug, and we're going to have a little conversation when we get back onto that hill. And God honors that. God blesses that. This is, I almost wish that the next chapter is different than it was, because this does not mean that David is never going to make foolish decisions again. This is, David is not a sinless person. David's faults are on full display, right along with his faith and his faithfulness. But I think what we see is David's sanctification in these chapters. I think we see his growth. I think we see his coming to understand more clearly the providence of God and the priority of God's revealed will in these chapters. And I think it's a cautionary tale for us not to try to read the tea leaves of providence, not to get bogged down, you know, trying to outsmart ourselves, basically rationalizing disobedience, trying to figure out what God is doing at any given moment or all of the reasons why what's really the wrong thing to do ought to seem like the right thing to do. It's this simple. I don't have to know when or how God is going to do the things he's going to do. All I have to know is what he tells me to do. And that's enough.